This is Ukraine calling.
So how are communists going to vote for Ukrainian independence?
Was there a feeling at that time how momentous this was? Was it emotional?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember that day, all these people were walking with flags.
We had problems from the start.
Oh, yeah. What did Stalin do when the Germans invaded? He disappeared. He panicked. Yes. This is what dictators do. People don't want to pay for content if they can get it for free. Yeah. Canadians don't like spending money on defense. We have gotten so used to the fact that the United States is this umbrella that protects us.
Hello, everybody. It's late August. It's a beautiful day in Kyiv and an ugly war. We are only days away from Ukraine's 33rd Independence Day, and a third of those have been spent at war. We come to you as Ukraine is fighting, advancing in Russia, and Russia is advancing in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That is how crazy and horrible this war is. There's also other aspects to the war besides the military fighting. There is the informational war. There is the media wars. Fortunately, I have a walking encyclopedia on all things Ukraine in the studio. Yes, the professor is in the studio. Marty Dichok, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's great to be here and see this wonderful studio and see you again.
Well, you had a lot to do with it. Regular listeners to Ukraine Calling will remember Marta is the original host of this program. She launched it in 2016. It did 124 episodes, and I think now, with all said and done, we're approaching 180 episodes, and hopefully we'll live a lot longer, Marta.
Absolutely, for sure.
And Marta, of course, is a prolific writer. She's a professor at Western University in London, Ontario. Ukrainian-Canadian daughter of World War II immigrants, and studied it a lot. She also has a strange vacation habit. She comes to Ukraine to do research when other people are at the beach. But Marta, how's your trip been going?
It's fascinating to be here. I follow Ukrainian events very closely from Canada. And coming here, you know, I wish I was on a beach, but this is way better because I get to see what's happening from the inside. And it's such a different perspective. Because when I wake up in the morning, I read the news. And of course, what is in the news? How many times Russia has attacked? How many people they've killed, et cetera, et cetera. Here I wake up. It's a beautiful sunny day because it's summer. And people are walking on the streets. They're going to work. They're drinking coffee. They're having meetings. They're doing radio shows. So life is so much, I see the diversity of life. In a way that from a perspective from Canada, it's just, I don't see that.
Life goes on until it doesn't. We want to talk about a lot of things today. And one of them is I'm really anxious to read and hear about your upcoming book, Ukraine, Not the Ukraine. Please tell us about this because it sounds so fascinating.
Thank you. I can't wait for this book. It's just about to come out with Cambridge University Press. It's a short book. It's part of a new series, and the series in elements, they're designed to present complicated ideas to a large audience. So it's moving away from the ivory tower mode. It's reaching out to society and saying, okay, here's Professor so-and-so writing a book about, in my case, Ukraine, not the Ukraine. And I chose that title because so many people keep saying the Ukraine. And I correct them. But the reason they do it is because the way they were taught history, Ukraine is part of Russia, which is precisely what Putin is saying. But that's not true because the history, it's actually Ukraine is much older than Russia if you go back to the history.
So you're aiming this book at people who don't. At the general majority reader. Of people who don't know a lot about Ukraine.
It's for the general reader.
And that's why it's important.
So my undergraduate students or people who read The Economist or, you know, they're getting on a plane to go somewhere and they want something interesting to read, that's my target audience.
Great. How long did that take you?
Well, that's a good question because it's only 70 pages long. And I thought, oh, this isn't going to take very long to write. It took a year. because to take 1,000 years of history
and boil
and put it into 30,000 words is harder than I would have imagined.
Oh, yeah, that's the hardest writing and editing of all.
But I'm pleased with it. And the way I did it is I focused on people so that it's an interesting story. And I slightly reframed the chronology. So the people that the reader will meet in my book are Prince Yaroslav the Wise and rock star President Volodymyr Zelensky and my former PhD student Max Zvyazhnev, who was offered a postdoc at Harvard after he finished his PhD. Mm-hmm. And then Russia invaded. And what do you think he did? Mm. He signed up and he's fighting.
Wow.
And I'm in touch with him, and so he's in my book, and lots of other people, Stepan Bandera, and Mikhail Hrushevsky, and Maria Burmaka, the singer, and various other interesting characters. And they are the heroes in the story. And the story is about what happened on Ukrainian territory over the past 1,000 years. And the focus is on Ukraine and its relations with neighbors and the world. So it's reframing and decolonizing the way history often is taught, which is, you know, here's Russian history, and part of that is Ukraine and all these other places. It's shifting the focus and saying, this is Ukraine plus the rest. And that's a trend in history that's been happening for the past, well, since Russia's war escalated. Mm-hmm. It intensified. So this decolonizing the field is something that many people are doing. And a professor in Australia, Professor Mark Adell, he set up this series on decolonizing, and he asked different people to write books on different topics, and he approached me to write this one on Ukraine. So I can't wait till it's out.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be called Ukraine, Not the Ukraine. I think it has a potential to be a big seller, because I do know, coming from America, literally from an overnight bus in Warsaw, so I hope to stay alive for this interview. But there's still a lot of interest and not a lot of knowledge. I mean, I broadly speaking.
Precisely.
But I know you know everybody. And before we launch into because I've read your travelogue on Facebook, you've met a lot of people already in your month, your August in Kyiv. Before we do that, you were here for the first Independence Day in August 24th, 1991.
Yes.
Can you reminisce with us about...
Yes. I feel like my life is one big serendipity. I came to the Soviet Union to do research for my doctorate that I was writing at Oxford on Ukrainian World War II refugees. And so my goal was to look at archives and see if there were any survivors that I could interview. But I got here and the Soviet Union was shaking. This was March of 1991. And I thought, I can't sit in the archives. There's something happening around me. So I contacted The Guardian and said, you don't have a reporter in Kyiv, would you like me to work for you? And after a little bit of back and forth, they said, we'll try you. And so I started reporting for them. And that's how I ended up being in Parliament on the 24th of August, 1991.
Wow.
And nobody knew what would happen. And there's this amazing documentary series produced by Oleksandr Zinchenko for Suzbilne Television, which is Ukraine's public broadcaster, documenting the events from the 19th of August to the 20th. So each episode is one day. And he found original footage from then and interviewed a whole bunch of people, including the first president, Kravchuk, the first security minister, Marchuk, journalists, myself, politicians, analysts. And what he captured there, which was precisely what I remember, is the uncertainty. Because the coup had failed in Moscow, but nobody knew what was happening. And Moscow still controlled the army and the nuclear weapons and the money. They still had all the instruments, the levers of power were not here in Kyiv. And this is something that we were very aware of here. Tanks could come here at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing was Parliament. they were majority were communists. So how are communists going to vote for Ukrainian independence? And Leonid Kravchuk, who was the speaker, he had been the ideology chief for the Communist Party of Ukraine.
Exactly.
He'd been fighting against nationalism. So it was very uncertain because the Democrats, they didn't have the votes. They had 125 seats in a 450-seat parliament. So their task was to convince the communists to vote for independence. And Kravchuk managed the whole thing. And it wasn't clear, really, what was going to happen. And then the historic moment came and the vote and ding, 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 you know, in parliament, that sound. And then they voted for independence. And it was this feeling.
Who do you give credit to? Was Kravchuk really a sly fox? Because that's the way they're...
Oh, yes.
They're, he's being portrayed in some histories.
He was a very astute politician. At the time, he wasn't very popular. And again, in this documentary series, I watched it and I thought, I'd forgotten that people on the streets, because there were lots of protests at the time, people were screaming, out with Kravchuk and Mosol. They didn't want him, the Democrats, because they didn't trust him. He's a communist. But it was a combination, a very complicated series of events. And the reason the communists ended up voting for independence is because they were afraid of Yeltsin. They were afraid of democracy. Mm-hmm. They saw the people in Moscow overthrow the coup. And Yeltsin on the tank, democracy, and they were communists, and they weren't the Democrats. So they were afraid, and they thought, right, if we separate, then that will not touch us. So that was the Democrat, the communist thinking. And the Democrats, you know, there were lots of different types of Democrats. Somebody like Dmytro Pavlichko, a writer, he was a Communist Party member, obviously member of the Writers Union, but he could talk to Kravchuk and the Democrats, right? So there were people who were bridge figures.
Was there a feeling at that time how momentous this was? Was it emotional?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember that day. It was, again, beautiful summer day like today. And I was walking up to Parliament, you know, it's uphill, and all these people were walking with flags. And they stood outside the building with their flags and their signs, waiting for what was going on inside. And they weren't going anywhere. And inside Parliament, which is where we, the journalists, were, there was this feeling of tension because nobody knew exactly how it was going to go. And the Democrats, they had help from various people like John Huco, who was here, a lawyer. He had a photocopy machine and he played a really key role in all of this because to put something on the agenda in Parliament, everybody has to have a copy of the document. But back in 1991, who had a photocopy machine? Nobody, right? And Lauko Lukyanenko and the Democrats, as the coup was failing, they drafted this Declaration of Independence. But they had to make copies for everybody. So they went to John Huco, and through the night, he copied them. So in the morning, they could put it on everybody's desk.
Yeah, I remember. I came in 96 sometime later, but it was a problem back then. And the people were outside demonstrating to make sure that the parliament did the right thing.
Correct.
You know, and this was a culmination, obviously, of centuries of struggle for Ukrainian independence. Mm-hmm. And I can still see the emotion today with it. Looking back, was there any sense, because of the way it happened, you know, the Soviet Union just sort of ran out of gas and collapsed, rather than Ukraine won independence by fighting for it. I mean, they've been fighting for centuries for it, but when it happened...
It was bloodless.
Yeah, it was bloodless. Mm-hmm. Did you have, in looking back, was there any sense that what we're facing today could happen? Or were people just thinking that that's it, it's a divorce, and thank God?
That's an excellent question. You know, hindsight is 20/20, and I've thought about this question a lot. Looking back, all the indications were there. that this is something that Russia is not going to let go. At the time, Russia was too weak to do anything about it. But in August, September, the fall of 1991, I don't remember people here being that concerned about Russia invading. The political concern was, would the referendum be successful? Because Parliament declared independence, but it had to be ratified by a referendum. How would the first presidential election go? How to organize an armed forces, how to organize the economy. Basically, okay, we declared independence, now we have to make it real. So that was kind of the mood that I remember. But a few days after Ukraine declared independent, Yeltsin issued a statement saying that Russian Federation doesn't recognize Ukraine's borders. And a delegation was sent from Moscow to Kyiv to deal with the emergency situation. And we heard about it because journalists all talked to each other. So we went to Parliament to see what was happening. And it was Sobchak and the Speaker of Parliament and a few others. They came to talk to Kravchuk and basically shake their finger at him. What have you done? And he's very clever. This is the clever politician. He had a whole bunch of people outside Parliament. He made them come to the Parliament building in his office because he was the Speaker. So he got the Democrats to organize a public protest in front of the Parliament building, you know, that square. And then inside the lobby, he gathered the press corps. And then inside the chamber, he had his deputies. So he made them walk through the crowd that was shouting, Ukraine, Ukraine, what are you doing here? And then the journalists, and we were like, why are you here? Why are you here? And only then did he say, gentlemen, come and sit. And they talked for behind closed doors, and they came out with a joint declaration saying, you know, there is no emergency situation. But that showed that Moscow, even though they were on their democratic path, they didn't like that Ukraine had separated. And the whole fall was about, you know, would the Union Treaty still be signed? And Ukraine was like, what are you talking about? We've declared independence. We don't want to be in a union with you anymore.
And you witnessed all that firsthand.
Yeah.
You know, such an important living witness to history, Ukraine correspondent, even as the Soviet Union was still alive or on life support.
Yeah.
Who headed that delegation?
Sobchak.
Sobchak.
Who was the mayor of Petersburg.
Yeah.
And who was the Speaker of Parliament? I can't remember his dark hair. I can't remember what his name
is. But that's a great piece of history because I did not fully remember that. And it's we had problems from the start.
Oh, yeah.
And that tucked in the back of your mind, said, this is not going to be an easy acceptance. No.
And then a year, one of the first things Ukraine did in September is they just started setting up an army. They appointed a defense minister. They started building a ministry of defense because Ukraine didn't have anything.
Yeah.
And economic reforms and energy. That was the other thing. They were like, we've got to get energy supplies. But within a year, Russia was trying to divide the military hardware, right? Because when Ukraine declared independence, they said everything on our territory belongs to us, including all the military hardware, including the Black Sea Fleet, including the nuclear arms. Everything is ours. And Russia said, oh, no, that's ours, Black Sea Fleet. So there was a fight over the Black Sea
that
Fleet.
That went on for years and actually decades, still going on. Fantastic. The 91% referendum, you believe that was a true, honest recording of the feeling for independence?
Between August and December 1st.
Yeah, of course, the referendum was December 1st, 1991. Yeah.
I traveled around Ukraine with my colleague, Mykola Vadison, who was working for BBC. And we traveled to many different oblasts. And our goal was to gauge public opinion. Because back then, there were no public opinion agencies. So how do you gauge public opinion? You do it yourself. You do vox popping, right?
Right.
We did it in east, west, south, all over the country. And the overwhelming response to how are you going to vote for the referendum was for Ukraine, for independence. And the follow-up question, why? And there was a variety of answers because, you know, it's easier to take control over your own space, historic answers. We don't want Russia here. You know, we have a strong economy. We need to focus on ourselves. A variety of answers. But the overwhelming responses were, I'm going to vote for independence. And that's what happened on December 1st. There's been some discussion about the accuracy of the numbers and the whole process, because some people say, well, people voted that much because they were used to voting. In the Soviet system, everybody had to vote. So it wasn't a real vote, that you were supposed to go and you were told to vote. So some analysts say that's what happened. But there had been a referendum in March of 91 on the Union Treaty. And there, the results were not 91%. They were 80%. So, I mean, that's a 10% difference.
But it's not close, it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And even, I think, in Crimea, it was a
54.
Majority.
Yeah, 54. Right, 54. That was the lowest. Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of strange things that happened that year.
Oh, God.
August 24th is the, in 1991, August 24th, Declaration of Independence, December 1st, the referendum, and then finally, only on December 25th, the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, that's when Gorbachev resigned.
Resigned, yeah.
Which was dramatic. I love showing that video to my students because, you know, whether you liked him or disliked him, he has gone down in history as a statesman, because when he saw it, there was no support, he left the stage and said, right. Okay, unlike what we're seeing in the Kremlin now, where that little dictator is holding on to power and squeezing everybody around him.
He's behaving a little strangely on this incursion, too. I think there was, analysis, but that's another topic. He seems to be doing everything else except dealing with Ukraine's incursion. So this is very interesting and very volatile. And we're reading that actually Russians are in Kursk, are actually accepting of Ukrainian soldiers.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the dictator Vladimir Putin is in Azerbaijan and doing other things. Yeah. It's a very, what do you make of all that?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, this reminds me of somebody. What did Stalin do when the Germans invaded? He disappeared. He panicked. Yes. This is what dictators do. When something happens that's unexpected and they're not in control, they freak out and they freeze and they don't know what to do.
It's not according to script.
That's right.
They've
lost control, and they just... So Stalin did the same thing. He disappeared for 7 days. Nobody saw him for 7 days when the Germans invaded. Now Ukraine has made this incursion into Kursk. What does Putin do? He didn't speak for a few days. No public statements. And then he goes off to Azerbaijan.
We still don't know what he's doing. It's bizarre, and he's done that many, many times. He did it... during the sinking of the Kursk in 2000. He also did that, if you remember, the few days after Russian troops basically shot down MH17, killing 298. He disappeared. That would be in 2014.
But that's typical behavior for dictators and tyrants. That's very typical behavior.
Wow.
I mean, if you contrast, it's so easy to contrast Putin and Zelensky, the way they act.
Right.
I mean, Zelensky, he's, whether you like him or not, he's always there. And when something happens, he reaches out to society. He goes to places that, you know, a bomb falls in the hospital. He goes there and he talks to people. And what does Putin do? He hides.
Right.
I mean, that's the contrast between a democratic leader and a tyrant.
I think that's beautifully put. Marta, you are the first guest I've had on twice since I started taking over the host. I think it's very appropriate. I'm very happy to have you here.
It's lovely to be here, Brian, in this new studio. This is great. And with this amazing host.
Yes, Marta was a flatterer. And she was also one of the original journalists, I guess, before the collapse of the Soviet Union, Ukraine correspondent for the Guardian, the famous London newspaper, and then became a professor at Kyiv Mohyla National Academy for 4 years, 1922 to 1996.
92.
Well, 1992. What did I say?
22.
Oh, wow. That is the sleep deprivation catching up. Also, so for 4 years, really momentous years also in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that was another one of those serendipitous things that when I came here for my research trip, I met all sorts of interesting people like I am now. And one of them, Serhii Ivanyuk, he said, the Soviet Union is going to collapse. We're going to create a university. We're going to need professors. You'll be finished your Oxford PhD soon. Do you want to come and work for us? And I said, sure. And he pulled out this piece of paper. I was thinking, yeah, right. He pulled out this piece of paper and said, okay, well, let's sign a contract. So I signed the contract. And then I went back to finish my PhD because I was here for just a 5-month trip that turned into a year and a half. But Soviet Union fell apart. They created the university. And I thought, well, I signed a contract. So I found a way to come and teach through this program funded by George Soros. It was called the Civic Education Program. And he gave money to this organization to send Western lecturers to all the post-communist countries to teach history, political science, economics, sociology, all the disciplines that the Soviet Union had destroyed.
Fantastic.
And so I came and I got to teach at this university as it was just starting.
What did you teach?
History and political science.
History and political, like you're doing now for Western University in Canada. Guy Mihail Academy was recreated.
That's right.
It was wiped out and the Soviet era.
It was closed down by Catherine the Great.
Catherine the Great?
Oh, yeah.
Even before?
Yeah. Okay.
I had Sergei quit on the program once. Yeah. Very fascinating history. And did you teach, what language did you teach?
English.
You taught in English?
Yes, because the vision of these people who created the university is this will be a modern liberal arts education that's going to be bilingual in Ukrainian and English. So everybody who applied to the university, they had to pass a Ukrainian language test and an English language test. No Russian, and that was a time when most people still spoke Russian. But they didn't have a lot of English language lecturers, which is why they were so happy to have me. And the students in those first few years, they were so amazing, and I'm in touch with a bunch of them still. And they have become, you know, movers and shakers, and they're both here and internationally, but they spoke English. And they wanted a non-Soviet education, and they were, you know, the cutting edge, but they were also very brave because when the university opened or reopened, they weren't accredited.
Oh, yeah.
It took a long time before the Ministry of Education accredited the university. So these students, they were taking a risk because they were going to a university, paying tuitions, working hard on their studies, not knowing if they'd get a degree in the end. As it turns out, by the time they graduated, they did. But the way the founders of the university conceptualized it, they wanted to raise a whole new generation. So in the first year, all they took was first-year students. And in the second year, those moved up and they were second year students and they took another batch of first year students. And in the third year, again, and then they had 4 years.
Interesting.
But they didn't want anybody that was transferring from somewhere. They wanted to teach them a whole new way of thinking.
Yeah.
And they did.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, you've lived through so much of Ukraine's early history. And it's so fascinating because I first came onto the scene in 1996. And I have to tell you, I don't know whether your impressions are, but there were not that many students that I had because I was on a journalism exchange program and I had to do everything through translation because I'm monolingual, as we say. Two things. There weren't that many who spoke English. Secondly, they were very, very hungry for knowledge, especially from outsiders.
Precisely.
We were foreigners, I guess.
Yeah, from the outside world.
Right.
Something that was not Soviet. Absolutely. Yeah,
that was a fantastic time.
Well, so is now. Now is very different.
Well, different, fascinating, horrible, all those things at once. Yeah.
But inspiring. I mean, the way people here are defending themselves and getting on with their lives and producing quality media and art and drones and everything. It's extraordinary.
Which segues me to also a topic of my interest because it's important for Ukraine domestically in its evolution as a democracy, but also in war because our image abroad and the information people get from Ukraine is crucial to whether we're going to get the support to do this. And the real journalism needs to be done, not PR journalism. Mm-hmm. You've met with a lot of journalists and I guess media managers. What have you learned from your trip about the current state of media?
That's the topic that I've been researching for many years, but right now I'm focusing on social media and war. This is a social media war. The latest example, the Kursk invasion, how did we find out about it? Was from posts on social media by Russians. So a lot of news is breaking on social media accounts, and politicians are using social media effectively. And it is also a place where disinformation is spread. So it's this multidimensional thing that's happening, phenomenon. And I'm fascinated by it, but I have more questions than answers. So I come here and my goal is to interview people who are engaged in the process in various ways. So government officials that are working in the information sphere, journalists who are creating content and using social media, and also analysts who study this.
What are they telling you?
Social media is the prime way that Ukrainians receive information about news, about what's happening with the war, and the most popular social media platform is Telegram, which is a Russian-owned platform. And the owner is lurking in the shadows, so it's very hard to identify him. Social media platforms like Facebook, Meta, Twitter, X, the owners are visible. But TikTok is hiding, Telegram is hiding, so that...
We're living dangerously.
Well, my research assistant back from Western, she sent me a cartoon this morning, and it's this Trojan horse that says Telegram, and then Russian flags all over it, and then Ukraine's big gate. And so this Trojan horse is being brought to the gate, and Ukraine isn't closing the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the government officials that I've been interviewing, Olya Harisimyuk, Yaroslav Yurchishin, and tomorrow I'm interviewing Member of Parliament Mykola Knyazhitsky, who has initiated a law that would regulate Telegram usage.
Hmm. Because that can be tricky.
Very
tricky.
Government
steps into
very
that
tricky.
Area.
Well, yes and no, because the discussion about regulating the internet and online media and social media is a global one, right? This isn't something unique to Ukraine.
True.
What's unique to Ukraine is there's a war going on. But if you'll remember, the United States has discussions about TikTok and who can use it and how it can be used. And Canada has already banned the usage of TikTok by government officials on their government work platforms. What they do at home is their business, but when they're at work, they're not allowed to use TikTok because
China.
They're harvesting data.
Right.
They're denying it, but this is the fear that this is what's happening with Telegram, and
the
that
Kremlin,
it's, that has links to Russia, to the Kremlin, and they're harvesting all this data, and that's part of what's going on in the war. So to just leave it is crazy. So there's these discussions about how to regulate it.
I hope they make the right choices, because they haven't always in the area of media regulation. So,
They're having discussions. They're consulting with the European Union. The head of Ukraine's National Council on Broadcasting, she's regularly traveling and meeting with her colleagues to say, okay, how have you regulated? Because the European Union has quite strong regulations on social media and how it can be used. And, you know, so things like, you know, child pornography and all of that on Telegram, that's not banned. And something that shocks me is...
Wait, in Ukraine? How can that be? Is that true?
But this is the whole discussion, right? Because
well, that's
an individual has a Telegram channel, and they can post whatever they want on it and share it with the world.
It's unregulated. Yeah.
And so this is where people are saying it needs to be regulated.
The other layer is artificial intelligence, but I think we'll save that for that.
You know,
because that is supercharging everything, because the way that they can analyze the Kremlin or the Russian owners of Telegram, this vast amount of
data
absolutely. Instantly.
Absolutely.
And that's the way AI works now. Yep. I mean, just like it does on drones, and just that whole, we're heading into a different, as this war has shown.
Mm-hmm.
What is then the role of, I don't know, the traditional legacy media organizations in all this? Is its role as gatekeeper of reliable information more valuable, or has it been replaced by social media?
That's a good question, but I wouldn't phrase it as a binary thing. What is happening is media is being transmitted through various platforms. And the role of professional media, legacy media, quality media, call it what you will, is the moral authority for society. These are people like yourself that are journalists who know what journalism is, who will not broadcast information without verifying it at accuracy, and that's very much needed in society. The quality news sources are losing out to anonymous, quick posting information on social media that are creating a lot of noise and confusion in societies. And again, in Ukraine, it's the war issue. In the US, it's questions of democracy and so on. So it is a real challenge for quality media. However, quality media and social media are not separate. I mean, I read a lot of media through my Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah.
Right? I don't have to go to the website of CBC. I'll just see what they've posted. And then whatever's interesting, then I'll go and follow up.
Exactly.
And that's how a lot of people are using quality media.
And when you talk to, and financing has always been a problem still. That remains.
That's the problem. Because having a YouTube channel doesn't require a lot of cost.
Nope.
Having a TV channel is expensive. People who want influence are using social media to exert power in a way that's very cost efficient. Yeah. And this is changing the media landscape overall. So in 10 years, it's going to look very different, not only in Ukraine, but globally, because people don't want to pay for content if they can get it for free.
No, they certainly don't.
And so how do you sustain a media organization that pays journalists, that produces quality products, if nobody wants to pay for your product?
Exactly. Because Google's not, Twitter's not, Facebook is not employing journalists.
Nope.
And that's, you know, and I come from America, this is a global issue.
It is,
books,
absolutely.
Books, because I'm stunned by the high level of basically conspiracy theories, I would call them. And this, I call it like screaming circuses of cable TV that like just trying to grab the audience with the most sensationalist garbage in some ways, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. And I, you know, so I hear you there. Well, you're a sophisticated connoisseur of the news media. What sources are your, I don't know, top three or five in Ukraine, your go-to sources on a daily, regular basis?
I like reading newspapers. I'm of that generation.
You mean print?
Online.
Okay, because print, we're dinosaurs. It's gone.
No, you
won't see press kiosks here very many.
I haven't seen any.
Yeah.
I start my day with the Kyiv Independent. I read their headlines.
Why?
Because they give me the information that I want. I want to know what's going on in Ukraine. I listen to CBC Radio. I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, Ukrainska Pravda, and Hromadske Radio.
That's so great. That's a great mix. So you're kind of you still believe in the legacy media or the gatekeeper role that we are. Not gatekeeper, but filtering, trying to ascertain what's true and what's not true.
Well, providing society with accurate, objective information. That's what media is supposed to do.
Yeah.
Not a whole bunch of noise that's distorted but that's the reality of, you know, the current generation. my students, they don't read any of the sources that I do. I teach this course on media and politics, and I start the seminar, it's a seminar, and I ask them, where do they get their news? Where do they get information? And all of them say social media. And I say, okay, well, social media, is it like a telephone? What do you look for? And what criteria do you use for selecting? And they very often can't really answer because they're just using the feed they get.
That's a trouble sign, yeah.
And then I assign them each a media source, and they have to follow it all term. And their assignment is to read the headlines every day. And then on our seminar, present to the rest of the group what CBC television were the top headlines. I give them the Cave Independent because it's in English. What CNN's main headlines were, what The Guardian were. I select a Chinese information source, Russia Today. I make them sort of look at all different kinds of media sources and then compare the different, what the headlines were. What was interesting in England was maybe not the same that was interesting in Canada or the US or Germany or China. And for them, very often, it's the first time they've actually read legacy media. And they're like, oh, this is really interesting.
Yeah, that's good. That's a plus.
But and they don't go there by themselves.
So you talk about what's reliable and what's not. Or
yeah, that's precisely.
That's good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So there might be a book in there, War and Social Media.
Hopefully. For sure an article, but hopefully a book.
Okay. Well, with you, I'm betting on a book. Maybe we can close out with Canada and the, sort of the touch, because I spent a month in America, and Ukraine is not the number one issue in the presidential election, for sure. But it is.
It's there.
It's there.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a lot of, and I did whatever I could, whatever platforms I could to speak about Ukraine. And there's, you know, worrying signs and comforting signs, a mix, depending, mm-hmm. if you go from country to country, from Germany to France to the United States to whatever. In Canada, it's been a reliable friend, but I have to say, since, and we talked about this a bit in March when we spoke, when the Canadian government came out and said they will meet their 2% NATO, spend 2% of the GDP, Canada's GDP on defense, which is the NATO standard, and Canada is a major NATO ally. But by the year 2030, I was so disappointed. Maybe you can give us a flavor of where things are evolving in terms of Canada's approach to Ukraine or what's going on?
Well, similar as in the United States, Ukraine is no longer the number one story, which it used to be. It's still in the headlines. People are still talking about it, but not nearly as much as it used to be. And, you know, that is understandable because there's other things going on. So,
and we're in the 11th year of war. Yeah.
So that is understandable. Canada's official position remains unchanged. We will support Ukraine. We'll be there as long as it takes. I have always said Canada could and should be doing more. The new defense minister, Bill Blair, is, in my opinion, really stepping up. And I think he's just announced recently during the Kursk invasion, he said that Ukraine can use Canadian weapons however they want. We're not going to be restricting you. Another aid package, both military and humanitarian. So they're present and they're active. But Canadians don't like spending money on defense. We have gotten so used to the fact that the United States is this umbrella that protects us. And we just don't like spending money on military things. And the state of the Canadian military is a topic for discussion domestically, because there isn't the modernization and the funding of the military that some people think there should be. So never mind not to NATO, but even domestically. So that is a discussion within Canada. So other countries are giving all sorts of military equipment. Canada doesn't actually have that much more to give because we're not supplying our own
Military.
So that's...
The Canadian variant in America, actually everywhere about Ukraine. There's raging debate of those who are very concerned or interested in Ukraine. There's only really three positions you can take on Ukraine. Isolationist, we don't care, don't give them anything. Mm-hmm. And what I call the middle of the road Biden, give them enough to keep them in the fight, but not enough to win. And then there's the hawkish position, which is give them everything now that they need to win. Are there elements of that debate playing out in politics?
That's exactly the same in Canada. And the majority is that middle position.
Let's just keep it going, or keep them in the fight. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope that changes, because we could use an end to this war.
Everybody could. This war and all wars.
Horrible.
Yeah.
But, Ukraine has inspired the world, I think, and they really know how to do a black swan event and get the war back into the global attention. And you're inspiring. Unless there's anything else, I think, Matt, this is a good point to leave our conversation.
Well, I think Ukraine is inspiring the world. It's inspiring me. And I really hope that they win sooner rather than later.
Yes. It'll save lives. Mm-hmm. Well, Marie Dichuk, I'm so glad you found time on your month-long research/vacation.
Or whatever. Vacation. That's a good
research vacation, whatever it is. And I'm glad you don't spend August on the beach. I'm glad you spend it right here reconnecting with what's going on here, because it's very valuable to take what you've learned back to Canada and also to write your books. And one of them coming up, be on the lookout, Ukraine, Not the Ukraine, Marie Dichuk, coming to your bookstores soon. I've read her other books. This one's going to be a great one if it's anything like her other ones. Oh, so,
thank you, Brian. Thank you.
And so happy to have you in, because you are the original host of Ukraine Calling.
Taken to new levels by you, Brian.
Thank you. And that's it. We will be back with you next week with another exciting episode. Happy Ukraine Independence Day. And
happy Ukrainian Independence Day. Absolutely.
Exactly, from one who was there at the start. And thank you all for joining us.